From London to Lisbon, from Cape Town to Charleston, we tell the stories of the people that make the world of international law and business turn. We give glimpses into their lives and provide insights from their experiences. These accounts come from every sector and every industry around the globe. Simply put, and without further ado, I am Chris Campbell, and you're listening to Tales of the Tribunal, where practice meets personality. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell. I'm your host, Chris Campbell, and this is the show, the business and legal podcast where practice meets personality. And I'm sorry to disappoint you, dear listeners. There is no Hamilton. There is no rapping. There is no singing, at least by me, on this week's episode. But we are back with part two of the episode that we began last week with Professor Benjamin Davis of the Toledo College of Law. I hope that you enjoyed that first part, and we continue that discussion here today. So without too much lead in, I'll just give you a little bit of an idea of what we talked about in the second part of our discussion. So from here, Professor Davis gets into an in-depth discussion of online dispute resolution generally and its practical effects and considerations on practice in terms of the COVID-19 outbreak, some things to be aware of in terms of advocacy, making effective arguments, and the gaps between the law and the use of online dispute resolution. So I think there are some great things to be said and some really great stories. From there, he also gives some great advice and some really interesting and I think very specific advice for young practitioners and folks looking to break into the world of international arbitration, whether that be as a newbie, as someone that's in the middle of their career, or looking to make a switch in topics or expertise. And finally, there's some great war stories that he shares that I think you'll get a good laugh out of and learn a lot from too. So without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. It is a little bit lengthy, but I think it is well worth the time. We'll see you on the other side. So Ben, thanks for joining us for this part two segment and for sticking around in the studio. Appreciate that.
Great. Happy to.
So shifting topics just a little bit. What, and understanding that, you know, that's a huge universal things that we could talk about, for a novice or for a layperson that is just hearing about ODR, maybe in response to COVID-19 and trying to figure out how they're going to go forward, what would you say, or what in your mind are the key essential things that one would need to know about online dispute resolution?
So I would say the first thing that's the most important is that you understand that even though you're going into an online environment, concerns that you have in any kind of dispute resolution that you have off or in the, you know, in courts or ordinary arbitration or mediation present themselves. So when you go online, it's basically an idea that I like to say, which is that technology is like water. It finds its level. And we've been watching for at least since, what, 75, when the microcomputer came out. So we've been watching for almost 45 years now, the evolution of the use of technology in various aspects of what people do in their work, as what lawyers do and all that. And as each part of the technology developments happens, the more powerful availability of devices, the development of the internet since like the mid-90s and all that. It's, again, technology is kind of finding its way as we get more accustomed to it. So just understand that because of this COVID-19 crisis, all of a sudden you have to think about, well, how am I going to have to do things differently in this online environment from what I'm used to, because I have to. In doing those things in that online environment, you still want to make sure that, for example, for dispute resolution, you have neutral dispute resolution, something else, that you're not getting played. I like a phrase I heard from a speaker who is one of the what's called the Central Park Five or the Exonerated Five, Dr. Yusuf Salam, in January. He said, you know, let's make sure it's technology, but let's make sure it's not tricknology. That's the question.
Mm. Okay. See?
And so that's the thing that you have to be thinking about in terms of when you move to these environments. So let's talk about, so that's the first level, is just technology finds its way. So let's think about maintaining the same kind of neutral dispute resolution features in this online space. So then the second thing is how you're used to working in the offline environment. And I like to talk about this in terms of before a hearing, just the way that people figure out how to solve problems, organize their briefs, all that kind of stuff. That's all changed. And for mediations or arbitrations, particularly that are ongoing right now, it's like changing horses in midstream. The way you used to work may not be a way that can work. The secretaries or the assistants are now remote, just to go to a basic one like that. Or alternatively, the lawyers are working remotely. The way that you access information is going to be through online technologies. The kind of meetings with clients are going to be done remotely. You know, going into some facility and looking at papers, I don't even know if that's still done, but you see what I'm saying? All of a sudden, all those things that are the ways that you prepare and you have a sense of how much time it might take or something, some estimate, it's all thrown up in the air as you kind of reinvent that. So I tend to think that a big part of all this is just the process of figuring out how to bring together whatever you're going to do as the lawyer to present your client's case. And that may be much different than what you imagine it was going to be. And I've been a fervent advocate of really those timelines that were agreed before this time period was this COVID thing happened, or whether in alternative dispute resolution or in front of courts. Let's be realistic about whether those timelines need to just be pushed back significantly or even things put in abeyance until we sort of sort out how to do this properly as an arbitral tribunal or as a court. You can't push it back forever, but I think it takes some serious reflection about what is possible. Now, I know a guy named Paul Hemley, just to speak on the court side, who is from the National Council of State Courts in the United States, and what he's saying is that basically, the courts that have been open to technology and been going down that road some, they are making a switchover at a pretty good pace with a lot of assistance from the service providers, okay? So they're able to stay open and do more of the things that they typically do. Well, courts that have not started down that path are obviously having a little more trouble figuring out what to do. They're higher up on what we'd call the learning curve with regards to what's happening. Just like those judges in those courts and those court administration structures, for arbitration institutions and arbitrators, same. There are arbitrators, I'm sure, who are happy to have everything be in hearings, physically everyone together. And the idea of them being on a screen with other people might be something that is just, they're just not used to it. Just like all of us being maybe using Zoom for a classroom as opposed to as a professor using technology like Zoom or the various ones my university has to have the classes with my students. It's an adjustment to, and somebody who is the authority figure in terms of being the arbitrator having to do that adjustment can be a little disconcerting or maybe greatly disconcerting. They may not even like it. They may not even, they just may say, no, we're just going to hold this whole thing in abeyance until we can actually have meetings in a room. So, you know, those are real consequences. Here's another thing that you have to think about also for people is what does it mean for an arbitral tribunal to be together? Does that mean that the three of them are in the same room on a screen with the parties being in remotely someplace else? Or does it mean the three are maybe separate in their own offices because they can't travel to wherever they could meet together? And so how does that dynamic between the three arbitrators happen? How do they make sure that when they have to deliberate over a particular issue, that the mics and everything are set up so that they are really, quote unquote, alone vis-a-vis the parties as they deliberate the arguments of both of each side? Those are kind of things that, you know, you have to think through and understand what kind of technology you're working with for that. There can be other issues that people get into which are along the lines of, well, does it make a difference if one of the parties is in the room with the arbitrator while the other party is remote? Okay, those kind of concerns some people have. At least what I've seen from discussions of people who've done a lot of work in this area, there's a group called ODR Latin America that's headed up by Alberto Elizabetsky down in Argentina, doing a lot of this for a long time. You know, his attitude has been basically, and he's working in the mediation space, is that those aren't really big issues of who's in the room, who's not in the room, with regards to whether both parties are there in the room or both parties are online, that mediators are savvy enough to adapt to that and take into account how to act neutrally between those parties as part of helping them to move that forward. But I'm not so sure that in a setting where you have an adjudicatory role like the arbitrator, who's a private judge, I'm not sure how that works. I can see for courts, maybe it's a little different simply because the courts have that authority coming from the state, so to speak. It gives them a certain kind of comfort with regards to addressing whatever dispute has arisen in front of them. So they might be comfortable with one party in and one party not being. And I know that there have been some places, for example, I think in Texas, there was a appeals court that used to have to go and meet from Dallas, which is in kind of the east of Texas, to El Paso, which is in the far west, maybe 800 miles away. And there was some weird rule in the Texas procedure code or something that made it that basically the lawyers could kind of not show up and it would not be a problem, okay? So they went to having these online hearings, and that ended up working very well with sometimes a lawyer in the room and another one remote. But that, you know, that actually worked. And in fact, in some circumstances, it was an advantage to be the lawyer who was remote because a judge pressed a button on their desk, which they called the "Look at Me, Buddy," and what it would do. Is it would have the camera start to zoom in on that particular judge. So already as the person, you're seeing, Judge X is going to be asking me a question. So you start to think about what you know about Judge X, and you're kind of ready in a way that when you're in the room, like I was at a Supreme Court oral argument in D.C. this January, where, you know, it's just coming fast and furious from all nine justices. And there's the technology has a way of kind of sorting for you in a way, and who pressed the button first will push to them first, that kind of thing. That could actually be an advantage to not be the one in the room, you know. Anyway, the point I'm just trying to make is this is an environment that will be most likely somewhat unfamiliar, particularly for dealing with disputes that are. You know, with large sums of money on board and all that, but that if the basic rules or visions of what we talk about when we talk about in the United States due process, principles of natural justice, those kinds of concepts are embedded in whatever the online space is, so that it is really neutral dispute resolution technology and it's not dispute resolution tricknology, then that may be an evolution that can happen that'll be very good and very easy, or not easy, but at least will be something that we can move to at a reasonable pace. Now, I wanted to speak to another thing about arbitration, somewhat more than with mediation, which is arbitration is a creature consent, right? So have the parties and the arbitrators agreed already on how their arbitration is going to go? Imagine they've agreed they're going to have a hearing, you know, in Paris for 5 days at the ICC, or in London at the London Court or whatever, or someplace, or Stockholm. Okay. You know, so everybody was planning on doing that, but now that's impossible because of all the lockdowns, et cetera. Are you going to go
sure.
to my hearing? Is everybody agreeing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a valid concern. I mean, and I think the other question would then be is that you've got all these clauses that are drafted, kind of like you just said, with one place in mind, and, you know, do you go back and, you know, just sort of give an amendment on all those agreements, or do you kind of deal with it on a case-by-case basis? I mean, that's a very yeah. tangible question.
Yeah, absolutely. My suggestion, if there's an arbitration already ongoing and you don't want to hold things in abeyance, then, you know, you better get an agreement from everybody that is clear, that everyone agrees that the arbitration can be done online, or done through some kind of technology, and everyone agrees on what the technology is, and everyone, you know, debugs what they, you know, gets to their point of understanding what the technology is. But if anybody is hesitating on one of the two parties, now this is a dispute has already arisen, you know, I would, as an arbitral tribunal, I would be very hesitant to hold a hearing online in the absence of that kind of post-dispute in the hearing, pre-hearing consent.
Sure.
Because just imagine, at the end of the day, you got an award and you're trying to get that award enforced. And depending on where you're trying to enforce the award, how comfortable are those courts with this online space, online procedures? How willing would they be to recognize and enforce an award? Would you start to come up against visions of public policy about what is a hearing, all that? I mean, there used to be, when we used to type things all the time, as opposed to having all this video, you know, the vision was that online dispute resolution was essentially basically a documents form of arbitration, on the documents, with the back and forth exchange of typed things between the parties being seen as documents. And most of the arbitral institutions had documents-only arbitration rules. However, it usually always said it was by agreement of the parties, right? So If you don't have that clear agreement, then your document-based procedure that was quote-unquote online might run up against the fact that you did not give the parties a right to be heard, you know? Because
exactly.
agreement to have a quote-unquote documents-only arbitration. And, you know, I don't know, I'm not trying to say to be too pessimistic. I'm just trying to point out that this can work with consent as you make the transition. But if there's absence of consent between the parties, then be very, very careful. Second aspect is also, even if the parties consent, are your arbitrators, or is the sole arbitrator comfortable with this? There are some judges, for example, in the States, because it costs so much money to bring somebody who's being held from a court, from a jail down to the courthouse, there's been a development of using remote technology for arraignments, where the first meeting of that person in court. And so the person would be standing in some room at a jail, and their lawyer might be standing in the courtroom, and there's a video screen where you could see the person. And you know, judges, given the amount of money saved as opposed to having to have, you know, officers take these persons, drive them down to the courthouse and all that stuff, the amount of money saved on this is significant. And so there are a lot of judges who have been comfortable with that. But there are some judges, depending on the type of crime, like if somebody's up for murder, they want that person physically in the courtroom so they can look at him, you see? And that's just that orientation of that judge. So by analogizing arbitration, you know, if it's a case that doesn't seem like a lot of money, although what that means, you know, a lot of different things for different people, maybe it'll be more flexible. The idea with on documents arbitration was kind of thought of as going to be smaller amounts in dispute. But if you got, I don't know, $1 million, maybe that doesn't sound like a lot of money to people. Okay, I'll pick the biggest number you can think of, you know, $2 billion. There's going to be an orientation. Want to see witnesses physically, see how they sit there, those kind of things. With the arbitrators dealing with those kind of issues, want that, seeing the advocates physically in front of them, all those kind of reactions that may be not logical, but are certainly human, could impact just how that arbitration could or could not operate in an online environment.
Well, right, and you imagine something along the lines of, say you've got someone that is a great orator or advocate in person, you know, they know how to hold their countenance, they know how to cross-examine, all these things like a pro, you almost have to retool and retrain yourself for your manner of speech, the speed at which you speak, how you do your presentations to be equally as effective. I mean, it's a completely different game.
Sure. I mean, for example, I've just recently seen a Zoom conference where somebody was doing it. And one of the issues you can see is at the beginning, what was the lighting like for them? Are they
right?
You could do the lighting differently so the person has more presence. Doing an argument sitting in a chair in front of some screen as opposed to that standing up in the room, you know, you are the energy in the room kind of thing. Different sets of skills, like, you know, sitting there watching the Supreme Court argument there, you know, standing in front of the judge at the lectern kind of. All those kinds of dynamics are just, maybe just some people would say they're just atmospherics, but they're just different. And knowing how to use the environment is something. I'd like to go even farther than that. Let's look at the actual evidence. What if you have digital evidence of some kind? I mean, you know, there's e-discovery and all that stuff. But there's also the use of technology to talk about technology, right? So there's evidence of something that's in technology. How well do you know the technology used as the evidence to be brought? Because I distinctly remember in the case of the United States versus Microsoft many years ago, there was some presentation that was done, I believe it was done by Microsoft, where they showed something to the judge. And the folks on the other side, I guess it was the United States folks, had an expert, technical expert, who saw some obscure thing on the Microsoft screen at one point and raised the issue with the lawyers. And then the lawyers realized that this was a whole problem with the way that whole presentation had been done, because they'd kind of finagled the thing. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was a big moment where somebody who could see the technical aspect of what was changing there could point out an inconsistency. Almost like you talk about cross-examination. Well, it's like cross-examination of the use of the technology in a way, which is another cross-examination. And
sure.
You know, and it was a good point. The judge caught that point once it was explained. But if you don't know what the technology is, or you don't have that kind of expertise on your team, you know, you might miss it. Not to say that some other person might, you know, pick that up. But I remember that particular point as being a very important one. So, I mean, these are things to worry about. But the reality is, does anybody want to get COVID-19? You know, so, you know what I mean? I mean, oh, let me mention another thing. You know, we like to have the famous stale, pale male, many people have seen, you know, to have sort of the older, more distinguished arbitrators kind of thing. They're a particularly vulnerable group right now.
No, exactly. Absolutely.
You know? And so how they, you know, just in their life, how they are dealing with that kind of risk. And I'm leaving to the side just the human, I mean, those are human elements, but I'm leaving to the side, and I know we're all supposed to be all tough and dynamic and all that, but I'm leaving to the side the whole issue of people having sick people in their households or having, doing this in front of a screen where their kids are nearby and all that. And all kinds of complications that are not there when somebody goes into an office, so per se, but that are there. I mean, there's been a number of issues. I saw something recently just here in the area of publications of in law reviews in the United States. Since the COVID-19 process or has been going forward, in the various moments in time when people submit drafts of their articles to be submitted to law reviews, that the number of submissions being done by women has gone down dramatically. And you'd say, well, why? And one of the reasons is that with kids being home, with the way that the allocation of time is frequently done these days between the mother and the father, or even single mother situation, you can see time has been taken trying to master all those issues that make it very difficult to spend the time putting together articles, at least at this point, until everything gets adjusted somehow. And those kind of concerns, I would say, probably are going on all over the place in these areas. In the areas of the law. And I think that men should be stepping up more, okay, but I'm just saying this is the point that has been seen in the actual submissions that have happened to law reviews, that the number of women's submissions by women professors has gone down. And that's a real pressure that people are dealing with in their life and trying to navigate it. And that's something that may impact. I'm not sure exactly which way the impact goes, but there's like this adjustment going on. Now, I do think that the technology helps to a certain extent, but again, it's getting comfortable in that space of how to go about doing that technology.
So you putting all the fellows on blast, you know. folks need to step up.
I mean, when I saw this article, I was like, wow, I mean, it was, you know, sort of one of these blog spaces for, I think it was Above the Law or something like that, one of these blog spaces about law professors. It was like, wow, that's really heavy, you know, that they would see such a drop in, you know, a drop in the number, just a drop in the number of submissions. And, you know, these are wonderful, bright people who've got great things to say about so much, but these other things are just impinging on, and the other things that are very important are just impinging in certain different ways, differentially among the population. And that can affect how teams operate together and all that stuff. But everybody's got to step up to make it happen. Now, unless things have changed, there's not a lot of real empathy out there in an arbitration or any place else for all that stuff. It's kind of a cold, hard business, you know, international business, right?
Right.
But all I'm just trying to say is that these are realities underneath that I think should be something that is at least a little bit thought about as we think about schedules of hearings, as we think about submission schedules, as we think about witness availability, we think about creating submissions and all that. And so that we might allow ourselves to be a little gentler with each other, even though it's a war zone. I understand some arbitrations. I saw incredible war zones, but to be a little gentler with regards to organizing this with more lag times. You know, I'm a firm believer in fast track and accelerated arbitration, but it's got to be appropriate for the kind of reality that we're all working our way through. You know, it's like we were water breathing, and all of a sudden we have to be air breathing. You know, that's a change. You know,
right? Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
So, you know, I do worry that some of the particularly aggressive people that I knew who would be kind of dismissive of these kinds of arguments would disagree with me. I'm just saying, you know, there's so much happening, and it's so differentially different in different parts of the world. I just saw that we were talking about there's just a lockdown for in a town of 10 million people in China because it's come back. This COVID's come back. Well,
exactly. Yeah.
Everybody's life there about how they're going to go about doing what they're going to do. You know, I saw in Singapore that they thought they were out of the woods and now they may not be.
That's happened too. Yes.
You know, every day it's something different. There's a lot of moving parts. So a little bit of flexibility, I think, is important. One thing I've recently seen that a number of international arbitral institutions came out with a common statement. I think, you know, like ICC, LCIA, Singapore, I can't remember all of them, but about moving to the online environment and how to preserve what's going on there. That kind of collaboration is what we're going to need in arbitration for trying to properly move these things forward. Let's take an example that you have an arbitration clause that specifies a place of arbitration and no one can go to the place of arbitration. What do you do? Again, if by consent, you got some flexibility, right? But what
right.
do you do about the award? Let's say the arbitrators have now gotten to the point that they were in deliberations. They have come up with their award. Would you have the arbitrator try to get to the city, or the three arbitrators get to the city just to sign the award physically in the city, even if they had done all their deliberations over the phone?
Well, sure. I mean, that seems a little bit unreasonable.
It does seem a little unreasonable, doesn't it? But, you know, there might be some place in the world where they're trying to enforce that award where they're going to say, well, it wasn't an award rendered in the city. I remember this wonderful story about, I think, the place of arbitration was London. The arbitrator was in Paris. And when he signed the award, he inadvertently put Paris instead of London. So the arbitration was a London award, you know, and all that stuff. But the award said on it Paris. And so when somebody went to enforce the award, there became this whole debate, I think, in the English courts about whether it was an English award or a foreign award. You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it was an oversight by that particular arbitrator, right? But and the end result was that it was considered a foreign award because it said Paris, and then it got enforced anyway through the, you know, recognition enforcement of foreign arbitral awards as opposed to being attacked as a local award that could be annulled, you know, and all that stuff. It went kind of a different way, but that was just a lapse by the arbitrator. But some places, you know, just to physically be there at the place of arbitration to sign it would be something. Another thing is you have these e-signatures. Can you do arbitral awards with e-signatures? I imagine if everyone consented to that, that would be fine. But my personal feeling is that, you know, having that written signature of arbitrator A, arbitrator B, arbitrator C on paper, we're still at that level in a lot of places to show that you know, you don't have to do a sort of a proof of what e-signatures are and all that stuff to show that that is truly the signature of arbitrator A, arbitrator B, arbitrator C. You know, you don't have to go through a sort of presentation of the technology. You just have the signature there on the document, maybe certified copies, right, that the institution certifies, and there's the chain of certification that could go. All those kind of things from the physical world are things that you have to say, do I make sure that there's some of that, even though we might have the notification of the award by electronic means or something like that? All those things you have to think through. And I don't know what the answer is on all those, but it's just, you know, there are pros and cons on each of them. But all of them are reasonable things to reflect on. And especially if you're the arbitrator trying to make sure your award's enforceable, to try to make sure that you are doing the things that will make that award not by some happenstance be considered enforceable because of some formal error you made by somehow trying to hold a hearing remotely when there isn't consent of the parties. Or it is possible that there might be adaptations to arbitral rules that would include those in the rules, so there'd be incorporation by reference of the idea of remote hearings. But even with those kind of incorporation by reference in the rules, if I didn't have consent by the parties to that online hearing, I would, you know, still be a little hesitant about doing something. Just like, in a way, analogize, you have a place of arbitration, say, we'll pick Vienna, and arbitrators, for one reason or the other, want to have the hearing in Geneva and stipulate that Geneva is de facto the same as Vienna, right? Just because of whatever.
Right.
Well, that's all fine and well if everybody agrees. But if everybody doesn't agree, I wouldn't hold that hearing in Geneva. You know, I wouldn't hold the hearing in Geneva. We just have to go to Vienna at a later time. Or even sometimes places where the place of arbitration there was a war zone. You know, like pick Sarajevo as a place of arbitration during the war.
Right.
Balkans. Well, you know, maybe people can't get there. I visited Sarajevo about a year ago, and, you know, all the buildings, you can see the bullet holes in the older buildings from the war there. And I'm telling you, it may be that you just couldn't have the arbitration. Now, is there a judge somewhere that you can get to agree to allow you, to authorize you to move the place of arbitration? Maybe you might, but then again, if you don't, it might be much simpler if both parties or all the parties agreed to move the place of arbitration. That's fine. But barring that, is that judge's decision going to be something that's going to be recognized for purposes of enforcement of an award by some other judge in some other country? You know, I don't know. These are all these imponderables that we're still working through. So I just want to encourage keeping it simple and acting prudently with regards to each of these matters.
Well, sure. I think that's fair.
Talked about the choice of the qualities of arbitrators. Have you picked up people who can do, who can look good, who can ask questions, who operate well in this online environment? They may be great in a room as an arbitrator, but, you know, on a screen, they're kind of befuddled. And that hurts their credibility vis-a-vis the other arbitrators. It's a lot of things that could be thought about, but I'm an optimist. I really am. No, let me explain. Because I did the moot court online, where I sat here in Toledo, and there was a team from Brazil, University of Brazil, and a team from India, and it was. There was a Canadian and me and a person from another place in the world. It worked. It worked. Now, is that because we've self-selected to be people who'd be flexible enough to do that? That's a whole other issue. But it was nice to see. And then, you know, and the advocacy was very significantly and well done by the students. But I did notice a couple different things that happen as you're going along. A student might say, well, you know, if you see tab 6, right? Well, where's tab 6?
Right. Right, exactly. And
then the physical, everybody's got all their volumes in front of them. You know, is everything set up in each person's setting so they have tab 6, or does tab 6 now really have to be a virtual, you know, a series of PDFs that are on the screen to the side so you can click on tab 6 and open it up like that and look at it? You see what I'm saying?
Those sure.
You have to sort of think through if you're going to do a presentation, it's going to be references to specific language and specific documents and things like that. How is that going to be transferred into this kind of online space? It's fascinating, but it worked. It worked, and they were. I told them at the end that they ought to form a law firm, you know, because they were really, you know, a Brazilian Indian law firm or Indian Brazilian. You know, they were all really great. But
actually, not a bad idea in a lot of ways.
yeah, absolutely. And but they just you know, to highlight some of the complexities. Now let's see, what's another aspect of this? How about capacity? Does an institution have the capacity to run cases at the numbers that are needed for arbitrations under their rules? I think like the American Arbitration Association has 100,000 cases a year, right? Well, if all that's going to be shifting to an online environment, is that an environment that's the AAA space, or is it an environment that, you know, people are basically picking technologies out there themselves and without the imprimatur of the AAA? How would the AAA, or I'm picking them as an institution, feel about what if the technology being used in one of their arbitrations is actually more tricknology, all right? Parties chose tricknology because one was new, more better than the other. And then your award is getting annulled because of that tricknology, you know? I don't know. But those are kind of things that you might think about, and I don't have the answer. But you'd have to think about it, because the providers of these technologies, they're trying to reach a market, and are they tempted to give some bells and whistles to one side as opposed to the other because one side's a more repeat player than the other? I'm not saying they are. But I'm not saying that they, but you could wonder, you know, you could wonder. We've had some cases come up recently where these have been really difficult issues to address, not so much with technology, but, I can speak to a couple if you'd like. Would you like me to talk about a couple cases where concerns have arisen?
Sure. Yeah, would absolutely love to hear about those cases, yeah.
It's not international. It's more domestic arbitration, but it's tied to this COVID thing. A lot of in the United States, there's been a lot of delivery of food to people at their houses, and those people who do those deliveries have arbitration clauses. And there's an entity that got created out in Silicon Valley, I think it's called fairshake.com, which is basically taking those cases and has computerized the kind of complaint that one of those particular delivery persons would make. There's kind of standard complaints. So, you know, you click in a few boxes online, it generates your complaint. And then that complaint is sent to, say, the arbitration institution, the AAA. And under a lot of those rules in those consumer settings, the idea is that it's the company that is, or the employee setting, the company is supposed to pay the fees. And so this little entity called Fair Shake has managed to, you know, 6,000 of these individual, relatively small arbitration complaints against another company, the company that hired these delivery people, and AAA shows up at the door of that company saying, well, the administrative fees are $9 million.
That they had agreed
in the arbitration clause that they would pay, you know, as part of leveling the playing field and you know, all the issues about class action being avoided and all that. All right, well, needless to say, the company that got these was a little shocked by that. And so one of the things they tried to do was to switch out of the AAA and to have basically what we call a test case approach, which was something that that was worked out by CPR. So instead of being a AAA arbitration, becomes a CPR arbitration. However, the process of developing the rules at CPR, apparently, and this has come out in the court proceedings that have gone on about all this, the company was part of designing the rules in a way that the plaintiffs against the company were not part of the participation in those rules. And that caused a real problem for the judge with regards to the apparent neutrality or lack thereof of the institution. Of course, the other side of this is that you're switching from one institution to another institution. How are you going to do that? Only by agreement of all the parties. But if you agree to go to the other institution and have the test case approach, is it really a set of rules that are going to be neutral for you? And trust me, the what I read about what the judge's reaction was quite something. Now, why would a judge be involved? Well, it's basically the company was saying they didn't, you know, this couldn't work. This arbitration clause wasn't working this way. And, you know, on the other side, the plaintiffs were trying to do, well, guess what? Motions to compel arbitration. Get the company to pay what it said it was going to pay, you see. So, I mean, that's an example of a complexity that can happen. Even if you have, like, for example, computerized lists of arbitrators and all that, and, you know, mechanisms for having how arbitrators are named in cases. You know, there were some issues that happened a few years ago where there was a person who was being named or was the next person on the list, but the issue was this person really sort of pro the repeat player or not? And then the parties were informed that this person was no longer available, so they had to go to somebody else. Well, it turned out that the person was available. It's just that the system kind of kicked them out because maybe they wouldn't be as friendly to the repeat player as not. This was part of the person involved in this. I remember it was now a senator, is Elizabeth Warren, you know, and she had to do an affidavit about it. It was a context of a defunct institution now called the National Arbitration Forum. But there it was. You have technology and you have all this stuff you're using. But turns out there's a little trick in the background. You know, I mean, these are things that can happen. And I remember when the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Procedure was put in place by the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO and ICANN and others, the International Council for Assigned Names and Numbers, I think that's what they call ICANN and all. And there were people who were doing studies about the decisions under that procedure, which is not quite arbitration, but sort of like arbitration. And, you know, there were comments made about who gets to be a repeat arbitrator as opposed to
right.
Who doesn't, depending on the one loss for the plaintiffs in those cases. It seemed that you would get a lot of decisions. If you did a lot of decisions that were favorable to the plaintiffs saying there was an abusive domain name registration, you got renamed a lot, you know? So these are all kind of things that you have to think about it so that that word neutrality really, really, really works.
Oh, that's true. What I suggest, what we can do, if you got a moment, Professor Davis, is the favorite segment, I think, of a lot of folks on the show is hearing you know, what some of the personal interests are of the guest. You got a moment for that?
Ah, sure. Okay. All right.
Okay. So we'll start off really easy. What was the last movie you saw, if you know?
Last movie I saw. I think we binge watched the Game of Thrones. Okay.
Game of Thrones. That counts. That counts.
I mean, because we're not going out to the movies, but yeah, we binge watched that. I came in and out along the way. I didn't like the ending either. I thought Shouldn't have been made into the. What? Spoiler alert.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I don't want to get in trouble. You know, those people take that seriously. Yeah.
That's right. So, anyway, okay, I'll just stop there. But yeah.
Okay. I think that's good. Okay, so then we'll shift a little bit again. How about music? What kind of music do you like? Who are some of your favorite artists?
I like all kinds of music. I'm really telling you. I really like all kinds of music. For people in international arbitration, I think that it's the fourth movement of Brahms' first symphony is a really wonderful expression of what it is like to work on the international plane. That always made me feel like I was living in an international environment, you know, dealing with people from different countries, you know, sort of in the UN or dealing in arbitration when I heard that. And the funniest thing was I went to the Palais des Nations in Geneva at one point, and I came into the visitor center, and it said, you know, welcome to the United Nations. So you're going to have that kind of thing. And that was the music that they turned in the background. I was like, I don't know something about this. It was something special. It captured that. So I like them. In terms of, I'm an old Grateful Dead head. I saw them in 2015 for their 50th at Soldier's Field, I guess it is, in Chicago. One of the things I really love about the Grateful Dead that finally hit me after 50 years was, you know, they don't come out and they don't do a lot of, hey, welcome, hi, Chicago, we love you. They just come out and they play. Their sound system is impeccable. Their roadies, all that stuff, it's just impeccable.
Yeah, okay. No, that's... So Grateful Dead, and then I want to make sure we got the name because I got to go check this out. So it was the fourth movement of Brahms' first symphony. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's the fourth movement of Brahms' first symphony. I
can check it
online here in a second, but I think that's, yeah. Then beyond that, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Sure.
The Gang, Allman Brothers, Boston. And Steely Dan. I had to do a thing online in Facebook. Is that you had to pick 10 album covers for songs without any explanation? That songs, albums that really struck you. Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding at Monterey Pop as an older one, but some of the other ones are Elton John, Madman on the Water. Steely Dan, a lot of Steely Dan. One of their greatest songs was Asia, and they came to play here at the Toledo Zoo. That was just heaven to see them, because when I got to like Steely Dan in the 70s, they didn't tour. So I went off to Paris in 83 and was over there 17 years. I come back to the States, and I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, they see Steely Dan is going to be touring and playing at the Toledo Zoo. I said, oh, they're touring again. Well, they've apparently been doing it for 15 years, but I'd assume you never could see them, and they'd broken up. But, you know, yeah, man, just beautiful music. A lot of jazz, you know. Cannonball Adderley Quartet. Back when I was in 1968, I was in the Netherlands staying at a hotel down by the beach. And I went downstairs and got a Coke, and there was a band playing, and it was the Cannonball Adderley Quintet.
Wow.
You know? And with back then, it was Joe Zawinul was part of them, and they played Mercy, Mercy, Mercy right there. You know, I'm just like a 12, 13-year-old, and this band is really good, you know. And then later on, I realized how much sheer luck I had. They're probably playing for the hotel rooms, right? You know, they'll play downstairs and they get their hotel rooms free and all. That, you know, that kind of stuff. All kind, really, there's all kinds of music. Country, I like my friend Waylon Jennings.
Sure. Waylon
Jennings and Johnny Cash, some of that country. Obviously, Chuck Berry and lots of rock and roll. I mean, I'm just all over the place. I just like all kinds of music. David Allan Coe is another country guy I like. And, of course, you know, Sinatra and Streisand and all those people. But if my heart was to be in one place, it would probably be somewhere between Steely Dan, The Dead, and Boston from rock and roll.
Oh, okay. No, I mean, that's a good palette. And I think that's probably – I think you get the award for the most robust answer on that question. You know, most folks give, you know, one or two artists that they like. But, no, that's a good palette. One question I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about in part one, but I'd be interested to get sort of the punctuation or the bookend on it is, you know, let's say you're approached by, you know, a current student or recent graduate or someone that's looking to break into international dispute resolution or arbitration, and they come to you and say, you know, how do they do that? You know, how do they prepare themselves to do that? And how would you answer that or how would you address that question?
So if it was a student and they had summers, I would say, you know, try to look where you would like to live in this world. I mean, if you're thinking about being in New York, it's one thing. If you're thinking about being in Singapore, it's another thing. But try to think of where you'd like to live and then try to identify people at law firms in those places who do exactly what you want to do, like people who you'd like to look like, people who look like how you'd like to look 20 years from now, 15 years from now, and then shamelessly apply to them. There's something about them that moves you, and maybe there's something about you that moves them when they get that application. I can't explain it any other way. So assuming that they don't come on campus and regularly interview, and shamelessly push to be able to get a summer job, even unpaid, with them, and then to work with them. A second way is to go to a, you know, apply and go to a law firm somewhere in your country, but always looking for law firms that have an international dimension, and then find the person who does the international stuff there, and just shamelessly from the first day, even before that, show your interest in what they're doing. One of the other things that they can do is while they're in school, if they have to write papers on the topics that are related to international arbitration. Why? Because you learn who the players are, so to speak. You can even interview the players. You just call them, say, I'm doing a paper. I'd like to talk with you about this. I know it sounds crazy, but you imagine sending an email to one of these great names like Gary Bourne saying, hey, I'm working on this issue here and read your book and this is that. If I was somebody wanting to get into it, I would not hesitate to contact somebody like that. You might not get an answer, but you might. You understand? You just might. Another thing.
You're giving away all the secrets, Ben. I mean, that's exactly, you know.
Yeah.
May have been part of the impetus for this show.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also, if there's an international, you know, there are these young arbitration groups that are there. There's sections like the ABA has an international, has a student section, but it also has an international law section. There's the, in the United States, the American Society of International Law, and they have people who do dispute resolution. As a student, particularly that it can be much cheaper, I would become a member of those things and try to at least go to the annual meeting where you just talk with people and meet people. And then in addition to that, of course, there's the moot courts, the Willem Vis moot court in Vienna or in Hong Kong. That is a wonderful place to become a member of a club because you're there at the same time as a lot of people around the same age as you, and you end up becoming friends, and it's like your cohort for the next 30, 40 years of your life. Plus, when there are opportunities that show up, like there's a big arbitrator needs an assistant. They've got their alumni network where they post jobs and all that, and you might find yourself a job through that. I remember when I worked at the ICC, and there were members of the court, I think it was the chairman of the court in particular, who went to the VIS in Vienna, and you know, they heard somebody argue, and they thought that guy was terrific. We have to find him a job here. That kind of thing can happen.
Can and does happen.
And does happen. Yeah, yeah. I do say that it is possible that there won't be a lot of people who will really understand why you want to do this, but don't let that deter you. And it may be that this is something that blossoms as an interest as you've been out there a bit. I always thought one of the important things once you started working, let's say you started working and you want to get into this, you know, one of the things to think about is could you apply to be one of these councils at one of these places, like at the International Center for Dispute Resolution or over at Stockholm or the Permanent Court or in Singapore or something? Could you become one of those councils? Why? Because those experiences, at least in my experience, I saw that a number of the great arbitrators I was dealing with, if you went back in time to their 20s, they had done internships at the ICC. You know, it was very interesting. As there was a significant ones, you know, when I looked at their path, they'd been an intern for 6 months or 3 months at the ICC, sort of after school or something like that. And so I think that, you know, getting that kind of experience at one of these institutions where you'll see a lot of stuff quickly can be also a wonderful way to build one's credibility in the space. Beyond that, usually to get to the international plane, at least in my experience, there came along a moment at some point, no matter where you were, where some boss would come down or send an email out asking something along the lines of, can you be in Bratislava next week? And you have to be prepared. Say that comes in at 5 o'clock on a Friday and it's sent out to three people. At 5 o'clock in 2 seconds, you do a reply all saying yes. That preempts
exactly
people. And now they have to deal with you doing it, okay? And then you go to Bratislava for that, was supposed to be a 3-day meeting. It turns out you have to stay 2 weeks because things are more complicated. You stay there for those 2 weeks. That's great. When you come back from Bratislava, you make a trip report to the person that you saw. You did what you did there, but you make a trip report in detail to the person who sent you, copy to any other big bosses about what you did. You know, back in the day, we would have these visitor cards everybody would give you, putting those in. Why? That lets everybody see that not only can you go to Bratislava, but you can represent them well in Bratislava. And you know how to deal in Bratislava. And so the next time there's something in Eastern Europe, them thinking, well, he was good in, or she was good in Bratislava, let's send them to Prague or wherever, or maybe back to Bratislava, and you may become the Bratislava person. You know what I mean? But that report back, rather than keeping all that knowledge inside yourself, that report, not saying that anybody's going to read it, but they'll see that you were doing a lot of things. You organize it well with a nice table of content. Another thing is, when you get opportunities to speak, go, you know, try to, maybe it could be being a moderator on a panel, and then maybe another time it could be something else. But when you do speak, try to make sure each time you write an article, write up something so that when people afterward talk to you about it, you've already given them something. Could be your PowerPoint, it could be whatever, but you're giving them something that they take away that has your ideas in it to help them remember who you are. I personally used to think that whenever I had to make a speech, I would try to write a paper. So that way people could get a paper. And ultimately, one of the things that happens with writing those papers was that I got contacted. I remember Jan Paulsen came up to me after I did a paper once at the IBA section. And he said, you know, we'd like to publish that in Arbitration International. I did, and I had to ask, gee, is it permitted? You know, I didn't, the IBA didn't care, but I didn't know, you know, but I was like, well, let me, and he said, I think it'll be okay. I said, all right. And so then all of a sudden I had this paper on pathological arbitration clauses that I'd done that was published in Arbitration International. And there are other things like that, where, because it started with a paper I'd written for the speech and then became a secondary aspect. I could use it as a publication, and it went to the places where people read, and so my name would get out there. You see, these kind of things that I would do. And you may have to start your own firm, obviously. I mean, for example, if I was somebody who really wanted to be in Singapore, right?
Right.
Then I would say, okay, well, what do I need to know to be in Singapore? English? I got that. All right. Should I learn Chinese? Should I learn Malay? I don't know. But if I would think Chinese would be a good thing. What kind of Chinese? Mandarin or
Chinese is good anywhere.
You know? You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then and then with regards to there in Singapore, am I a lawyer, an American lawyer? Okay, how can American lawyers survive in Singapore? What are the rules about foreign lawyers being in Singapore? There are law firms that I could be, you know, a foreign lawyer in the law firm. If my long-term vision, like say my spouse was from Singapore, it'd be like, well, maybe I need to do an additional degree in Singapore. And this is true if you're from Singapore and you think about being in New York, same thing, you know. It's maybe I need to do an LLM here in the United States and become a member of the U.S., a member of the bar in the United States, if you're going the other way. But those are kind of things that you try to think through as you make these choices. The only maybe last point I would make with regards to that was particularly for law students is that, especially this time of year, we're around graduation. My contracts professor first year said to us that after law school, that famous life that you wanted to live, the famous life you may dream of, you don't maybe not even talk with anybody about, it's just kind of your idea in your head. Well, right after law school, start that life. Go to that. So when you're picking your jobs, if you got student loans and all that, I know you're worried about how to pay them off and all that. But the focus should be on what kind of the life that you want to live and how to get to that life that you want to live as quickly as possible, is what he said. And then you go and you find something, hopefully, and you work at it. And then after a year or two, you either love it or you don't. And if you don't like, you switch to something else. And what is that something else? Something else that you think you'd like. And that was advice that it stood me in good stead. Now I'm 64. I got a law school at 27. So that's what, 37 years. That went like a clip. I just snapped my fingers. All right. So that race to get to what you want, I can't emphasize it enough. I had a choice of going to New York, work in a law firm, or work on the other side out of Paris on my business side. And I was like, New York, go to Paris. I really wanted to be international. I went to Paris. That's where my wife ultimately was from. She was my fiance at the time. There I worked one job, then a different job. And finally, by 30, I was working at the ICC, and that was exactly who I was. I was so happy to be at 30 in Paris doing completely international work with an international group of people, but I wasn't in the government side of things. I was still in the private sector, and I was doing law and business. You know, it was just all these different pieces, English and French. Here I was, and that was at 30. You know what I mean? It's wonderful. And that's the next, 14, 15 years, or maybe 17 years, I guess it was. I was 14 there. There I was. You know, it's just wonderful. Another thing is that if you do go work in a law firm and you say you go to New York and you want to be in Singapore, well, if you have a fiance who is in Singapore or from Singapore, rather than telling everybody how great internationalist you are, you might tell the folks at the law firm, hopefully it has a Singapore office, that your fiance is Singaporean or lives in Singapore. And that's why you'd like particularly to go to Singapore, because more than you're talking about how international you are, the the fact that you have that strong tie to that foreign place might convince them that you're really serious, that you're not just there to do some touristing, you know, that you really want to lay down roots. I have a friend of mine who's French, married to a Taiwanese woman. He's lived in Hong Kong 30 years, you know, doing all kinds of things in banking. Well, those kind of things, people say he's serious about being out there. He's not just going out there to do some visiting and all that. And I know that that had an impact when I was applying for jobs in the States, saying I want to go overseas, as opposed to showing up in Paris and applying for jobs there, where they say, hey, he's really serious about his wanting to be here in Paris. But the thing I didn't know is that I should have maybe pitched it differently when I was talking for the jobs in the States and saying that my fiance lived in Paris. And so that would have been probably a better argument to make to get to the Paris offices than the one I was using at the time, which was that I'm an international guy and I really want to live in Paris. And, you know, that's natural for me and all that. That I kind of started to run up against the, well, come work in New York for a couple of years and we'll see. And my feeling was that the we'll see would end up being a no. But that, so I went down the business side. One of the ironies in my life is that when I was chair of the ABA section of dispute resolution, we ended up having meetings in New York, and law firms were offering their offices for those meetings of various committees and all that. And so our meeting ended up being at that law firm that I had the application to and was supposed to go work with in New York. This is like 30 years later, right? You know, I was like, this is very heavy, you know. This is very heavy to be here at this law firm when I could have started here 30 years before. And, you know, you look at your path, right? And you know, for me, at least, that advice of trying to figure out what's that life you want to live right away and going to it right away, and then if you're not happy with what you're doing, switching to the next thing and on and on, you know, that's really, really, really has been excellent advice that that Professor Rakoff, who was my contracts professor, gave me. And it stood me in good stead. I'm not sure if it stood anybody else in good stead, but it certainly stood me in good stead.
Well, I think it's really great advice in that I think a lot of people, especially in law, but in across a lot of industries when they're first breaking in, just kind of miss that, you know, getting your name out there and rising through your profession. Sure, there's a lot of hard work, and then there's the work of actually, you know, doing it. But it's also marketing. You know, if you want to be an advocate for someone else, you be your first client and, you know, persuade people, you know, why should they take a chance on you? You know, I think those types of things, and it doesn't always have to be because you are, you know, the world-renowned best person ever. It's because you have the gumption to try something a new way, or just that you're willing to do the work and you're available.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not trying to minimize the point of you have to pay your dues. You know, I mean, everybody has to pay your dues. You have to learn how to do these things. But the thing is like thinking very clearly about, you know, where you want to pay your dues, with whom. Are these people that you are you going to be the smartest person in the room with the people you're working with, even though it's paying you a lot of money? I don't know. You know, that is there somebody that you can really learn from? I mean, there are people that I'm so fortunate to have learned from, or had the opportunity to learn from over the path that you know, just made so much difference to how I've become, and then it impacts back to my law students where I try to transmit that to them, right? You know, just get that sense that what's possible on the international plane. So, you know, you have to pay your dues. You just be careful in picking out. That's why I like the idea of people looking at the little CVs that the Martindale Hubbell or whatever it is has of four different law firms. You know, it's amazing the connections that happen. Like, for example, I know a student who was looking for a summer job, and the summer job, say, in pick a country, I'll call it, say, in Japan, and the law firm is whatever. And they end up that the partner who's looking at them is somebody who is, say, Italian, right? And it turns out the student here in the United States, you know, she's half Italian. All of a sudden, there's this Italian connection that picked up with this person in Japan. And that was part of them getting comfortable with each other, and boom, they're on their way. You see what I'm saying? There's these amazing, Well, you kind of pick up from the why this person would look at you from Ohio and say, yeah, come on to our office here in Kyoto or something like that. You see? It's just amazing if you have that gumption to try to push a little farther.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, again, you know, we could spend hours chatting. So we're coming towards the end of this second part, Professor Davis. The last question that I have for you,
yeah,
is it's a two-parter. The first part is it's 5 p.m. on a Friday. You don't have any, you know, papers to grade. You don't have any, you know, work plans for the weekend. You can wave a magic wand, do whatever you want. How would you spend that weekend?
Can I travel?
Yeah. You can be there instantly, you know, like a magic wand.
Well, if it's in the summertime, I'd like to go to the Ile de Ré off of La Rochelle in France. And there's a hotel called the Hotel de l'Océan. It has great food, and rent a bike, and you can just ride around on bikes on the island. That is a pretty, pretty, pretty heavenly place for the weekend. Let's leave aside jet lag and all the rest of it. So I would love my wife and I to go there, and that's in the summertime. In the wintertime, where would it be? Either be Paris or Quebec City. Great food, great people, lots of friends.
Okay. Well, that's good. That sounds amazing. That's a great weekend. That might even turn into a, you know, we'll see you in a month or something sort of.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the second part, and I think this is, you know, hopefully in the same vein. Do you have any shout outs you want to give to the folks listening at home?
Shout out to the folks listening at home. So first to my wife, Odette, who's downstairs listening, hopefully with the doors closed enough so she's not hearing all this, because really keeping life going and really being the heart of what's going on, she's really special. I actually met her working in arbitration. It's one of those ironies of life, you know, friends for 20 odd years and then ended up getting married after it's all. So who knows what life will do, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Other shout outs. Well, let me, I wrote a poem actually in honor of two people. So let me speak to them. One is your guy, Michael McElroy, who has been sending me information on Facebook every once in a while about what's going on in Italy. And that has been helpful for me since Italy's have been ahead of us here in the States on this COVID-19 thing. And just his willingness to share has been really something that has meant a lot to me. The other one is this friend of mine, Pierre-Philippe Martin in Hong Kong, who, you know, early on told me three things: wear a mask, hands often, and stay home. Those three things: wear a mask, wash your hands often, and stay home. Long before the United States machine of information got around to those things. And, you know, I really think that between the two of them, they really have done a lot to help me save my life from this, because I'm in that group with the target on their back, so to speak, and the older folks probably got me to do some things that I really appreciate. Beyond that, I'd like to thank you, and I'd also like to speak to all of the people who are out there who may be early in their careers that I don't know. What I'd just like to say to them is that if you're bitten by this international bug and this international arbitration bug, it's okay. You are not crazy. You are actually on to something wonderful. And so let me encourage you in that path. I know I met a woman lawyer in Sarajevo, who had an older lawyer look at her and say, you know, you're too passionate about international arbitration. You walk around with crazy eyes. You need to calm that down. I'm here to say, don't calm it. It's okay. Build it. Find the places where people are doing the things you want, whether it's the ICA groups or the young arbitrators groups at different institutions and all. Get in there and move yourself forward. You know, don't assume that just because you're the new kid, you don't know anything. Just accept that you're going to figure it out. And you figure it out to now, you'll figure it out along the way. Even whether you're recognized or not, just own your greatness. Just own how great you are for being willing to go there and do those things. I think about all of you who may be working an awful hours trying to get things done and all that, and maybe despair somewhat, particularly with this happening, with this craziness happening with the COVID in your lives here. But keep some hope. Keep some hope up, because you are good for wanting to try to move into that space, I firmly believe. Those are the only ones I can think.
The only ones? No, that's great. And I think along those same lines, when you speak about your colleague in Hong Kong, I had a similar friend, Wesley Pong, who's a lawyer there working in international arbitration, who gave me some similar advice. And then my roommate when I was living in Beijing, Kevin Ferozian, really broke it down as these things were unfolding. So I guess those are my reciprocal shout-outs.
Yes. Absolutely. Helping us make this life.
So, Ben, you wanna sign us off here for today?
Sure. I am Benjamin Davis, and there's no disputing it. This is Tales of the Tribunal.
Great. Thank you so much, and we'll see you all next time.
So there you have it. That was the rest of my conversation with Professor Davis. It was a great opportunity, a great time, and just a really fun experience to have a chance to sit down and talk with him over the past couple of weeks. So one further thing that I hope that you took out of that conversation, and that I would strongly recommend to everyone that's listening, no matter where you are in your career, we all have this sort of weird opportunity, unique opportunity to develop some additional skills, to make the use of this time that we have where we're not at the office, that, you know, for lack of a better phrase, for most of us, we have the ability to work from home. And I think there's some opportunities there to really work on developing either a new skill or rebranding yourself or developing a reputation in a new field. So yeah, see what you can do during that time. Another secret that I will give you for those of you that are in that weird segment of the Venn diagram of listeners to this show but didn't attend the virtual tea session that we had a couple of weeks with Careers in Arbitration, Mandy Lee and I are working together on trying to put together a second session. So we will follow up with you here in the next week or two and let you know the details, what kind of tea we'll be drinking, what we'll be talking about, what the topic is, and maybe there might even be a special guest. What? Yeah, that's right. There might be someone else joining us for tea. So, nevertheless, I would also mention these last two things. First, by the time that you're hearing this on Thursday, it should be that we have launched something that we've been trying to get up and going for a long time, and that is our Patreon account. That's right. Tales of the Tribunal now has a Patreon account. There are exclusive benefits that you as listeners can take part in. You can make a donation or not, but it's a good way to support the show, to allow us to continue operating, to make the magic happens that goes into making this show, whether it be from a research angle, from the production quality, to all of those fun things that are making Tales of the Tribunal. In any case, the URL is included in the show notes, but if you Google Patreon and Tales of the Tribunal, it will absolutely come straight away. Finally, on that point, if you have any questions, comments, feedback for the show, you can get in contact at talesofthetribunal@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We would love it if you would leave us a review, if you would like and share this post that comes out every week on LinkedIn, and give us your thoughts. In particular, not just leaving a review, we would also really be curious to hear, what guest would you like to see on the show? We've got a lineup, of course, but I'm always curious to hear who you as listeners would like to hear from and what industry topics we should cover, or anything else you want to share about the show. I love seeing your messages. And finally, I would be remiss, and this is going to be a regular shout out that I give at the end of the show, usually around this segment, is a big shout out and a big thank you to Ramit Kohli, who is a student at the National University of Delhi, or the National Law University, excuse me, in Delhi. And he is my research assistant on this show. He makes this magic happen. He's a third year law student, and he has put in great work in helping get the guests prepared, getting questions together, all of those types of things. So thanks, Ramit. Keep up the good work. Without further ado, I think that's enough. This might be the longest segment too for the end credit notes. But without further ado, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for listening. And we'll talk to you next week. And remember, there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal. And we'll see you next week.